Eric Yalik, from the Woodlands, Texas, attorney registration number 21144. May it please the court. My name is Eric Yalik, as I just stated. I represent Dr. Peter A. Leininger, who is the appellant from Durango, Colorado, and San Antonio, Texas. I'd like to very, and by the way, we pray that the court reverse the trial court's judgment and render a judgment that the easement, the express easement, goes from to the east, the dry fork draw, and to the west, the slopes that are west of the west edge of what is called the upper road in the record. I want to very briefly discuss with the Court of Appeals three points. First of all, this case involves an express easement, not an implied easement, not an easement by construction or by necessity. Second of all, I want to briefly discuss the language in the instrument. And third, the use for a long time subsequent to the express grant that occurred in 1953. The reason that, that it is important that this case involves an express easement is that Dr. Leininger believes that where the trial court and perhaps even the appellee's briefing in this case have erred is in treating this dispute as though it concerned an implied easement rather than an express one. With respect to an express easement, the law, I believe, is pretty clear from the Eisenberg case of the Supreme Court that the location of an express easement is determined by the practical application of the express grant and the use of the parties a long time subsequent thereto.
Excuse me, counsel. I just wanted to understand. You indicated what your prayer was at the beginning.
Yes.
And is the boundaries of that easement that you asked that be recognized, that differs from the express easement?
No, Your Honor. I believe that that is the precise language of the express easement. There is certainly a question that arose in the trial court as to precisely where the west and the east were, but I believe that the appropriate interpretation of the express easement is, as I stated, that the west is the slopes that are west of the current upper road and the east is the eastern edge of the current dry fork.
And how do you get to that from the language of the express easement? I don't recall reference to slopes.
Okay, certainly not, Your Honor. The express easement states between the fence and the draw as now located, together with the rights without limitation to transport or drive livestock over and across that strip. Actually, my third point, and I'll get to that right now, is that the evidence before the trial court was quite clear, I believe, that the real purpose of this easement in 1953 when it was granted was that the Lemons wished to use this easement or right-of-way for the purpose of driving livestock, because at that time there was not really a residential use of what is now the Silver Mountain Guest Ranch. Where they were actually driving livestock was in the area that I described that in my prayer and also in the prayer in the brief, that basically the livestock was as livestock, and I think both Appley and we stated in our brief, livestock don't just walk narrowly down a road, they do tend to wander. And in fact, there was quite a bit of testimony in the trial court from Robert Watson, who was a DOW employee, Mike Zagainer, and also Penny Lemon Compton, who actually was a child of the Lemons, who were the grantees under the easement, that was the precise use for the right-of-way at the time that it was done in 1953, and that is the use since that time as well. The testimony, and I believe the evidence is pretty clear in the trial record, that even the road, and the problem here, I believe, is that what happened was that an express easement was basically reformed by the trial court to be a current road as opposed to the express language that is in that easement.
Just so I'm clear on this, the current upper road, most of it isn't in what you contend is the express easement, right?
Actually, Your Honor, I believe that the current upper road is entirely within the express easement. The trial court certainly in its initial opinion in February of 2007 and then in some statements that were made, I believe in May of, 2008 or 2009, the third hearing that we had. In that opinion, the trial court stated that there were portions of the upper road that are not contained within the easement. But the problem with that interpretation is that the express language states that there is this right of transporting and driving livestock across said strip. Said strip in that express easement is modifying the language that is between the fence and the draw. And so the strip that we're actually talking about, or that Mr. Thompson and Mr. and Mrs. Lemon were talking about in 1953, was specifically a strip so that you could drive livestock over it. The testimony in the trial court was not only that there was driving of livestock, but also that the long-time use after the initial grant in 1953 was that it wasn't restricted to the road. And as late as in the mid-1990s, when what is now the Silver Mountain Guest Ranch was the science camp of the Rockies, Ms. Compton testified that really the road was probably as wide as 100 feet because...
Say the road, you're talking about the lower.
No, the upper.
The upper road, okay.
That the upper road would get muddy, that they would sometimes go off the upper road as far to the east as 100 feet. Because there are stretches of this road, and I believe the record will reflect this, that where the upper road is, gosh, maybe even 200 or 300 feet west of the Dry Fork draw of Lightner Creek. So I think that both the express grant contained within the 1953 easement and the long time use subsequent thereto, both when Chester Thompson owned the Servient estate and then when he gave it to the Division of Wildlife in 1973, even after that time period, the long time use was very clearly that entire area that I'm describing that was contained within my initial prayer.
What would be the approximate width of what?
It would vary quite a bit, Your Honor. In some areas, particularly towards the southern end, it really probably would only be about 24 to 25 feet. In some areas, especially as you get farther north, right at the northern terminus of this easement, it would probably be several hundred feet wide, probably 300 to 400 feet wide.
Is that a measure of some geographic feature that limited how far the cattle could wander?
It's really only a measure. What I'm describing is only a measure of what is now the eastern edge of the Dry Fork and also what is the western edge of the slopes. However, Your Honor, I'd like to point out that there was evidence in the trial court, and it was particularly documentary evidence, that showed that while the Dry Fork draw of Lightner Creek did in fact move, as you might expect over a 57-year period, that the northern portion of that movement actually was quite minimal. And so even back in 1953, the width, just as you got to the Lemon Ranch, was quite wide. I'm sorry.
I'm still troubled by how we get to the western slopes. And is that because of the way it was used, or are you saying that the fence was right along the went along these western slopes?
Actually, Your Honor, as at that northern terminus area, even the lower road ended up in approximately the same northern terminus as where the upper road does today. And so I guess the answer to your question is yes, that even that lower road fence, the western edge, was approximately where the western edge of the upper road is today. The eastern edge of that
north. I just ask it this way. Is the western slopes that you're asking for to be the now the western boundary, is that exactly the same as the fence that's described in the easement?
It is in the northern terminus, I believe that it is. In the southern, in some portions of the southern area, admittedly, it is not.
So there are parts of what you're asking for now which go outside the originally described easement.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's correct.
And so you're saying the entire road lies to the east of what was the original western fence line?
I believe that there are portions of the upper road, especially at that northern terminus, that are west of where the original fence line was, and certainly west of where the strip where livestock was being driven in 1953 and as late as, you know, in the early 2000s even.
That evidence is what, in survey? How do we find that evidence to support that, what you're saying?
It was primarily testimonial evidence, Your Honor. Penny Compton, who was a child, as I said, you know, she's, I believe, in her 70s now, and she was growing up and actually lived through all of these interactions, because this originally was actually a lawsuit. This arose out of a lawsuit between the Thompsons and the Lemons that was settled, and so there was quite a bit of interaction both before, during, and then also after the lawsuit, after it was settled by the express grant of this easement. If I may, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Bradley W. Cameron. My registration number is 11183. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Colorado, and I am here representing the Colorado Wildlife Commission and the Colorado Division of Wildlife. This case for this court is a relatively simple case that can be answered by resolving two questions. The first question is the 1953 agreement ambiguous in regard to the location and width of the access easement that goes across the Thompson property to the Lemon property? Now, if the answer to that question is yes, then the second question is, for this court, is there sufficient evidence in the record to support the trial court's findings of fact, rulings, and decree? Now, I would assert that the answer to both of those questions is yes, and therefore this court should affirm the trial court's decree.
Where do we find the findings of fact that support the decree? Because the decree itself does not appear to have findings of fact in it. Do we go back to the February 2007 order?
That, and then as modified by the, I'm trying to remember, it was the upon a request for new trial when the judge ruled again on that. And then, Your Honor, the decree.
That little minute order that he issued?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the decree, when you look at it, does certainly have the meets and bounds legal description, which is what, when the trial court proceeded to rule and say, this is where we think, the trial court says, this is where I think the easement is located. And that's in the decree. Now, I do think it's important to emphasize what Mr. Yolick just said, which is that this lawsuit really is a continuation of the dispute that arose back in the 1950s between the Lemons and the Thompsons. At that point in time, back in the 50s, the Lemons owned the 160 acres of land that is now owned by Dr. Leninger. And what should be understood and wasn't perhaps clear in the briefing is that 160 acres is surrounded on three sides by national forest. And on the southern boundary of that 160 acres is the property that in the 1950s was owned by the Thompsons and is now owned by the state. The only access to the Lemon property is across the Thompson property. And back in the 50s, that obviously the tension associated with that is what gave rise to the lawsuit. Now, what happened back in the 50s is the parties reached a stipulation, and they memorialized that in terms of the 1953 agreement. Now, regrettably, neither Mr. Yolick or I attached that as an appendices to our brief, but I really would encourage the court to take a look at it, because I think it does help give context to what is going on. It's only about three pages. It states Exhibit FF, and both of the briefs cite to the record of where it can be found. The relevant paragraph is paragraph one, where the Thompsons granted this access easement to the Lemons. And the relevant pertinent language is in that paragraph one, as Mr. Yolick has said, is the language that describes the location of the easement as a strip of land between the fence and draw as now located. Now, going back to the very first question that I outlined, question is that language ambiguous? And we are really, I think, left, pondering. You read that language and, what fence is it that the parties were talking about in 1950? It's not clear. What draw are they talking about? They talk about it being a strip. The language itself simply is ambiguous. And the reader today, over 50 years later, is left just wondering what happened. Now, it would be curious and interesting to know, you read the 1953 agreement, and it would appear obvious that the parties had legal representation. Did counsel say, you might want to survey this so people can know, or did the parties just say, we don't want to? What happened? We don't know. But today now, we are left with this question of trying to decide the location of this easement. Obviously, it worked for the Thompsons and the Lemons. They may have no further disagreement as far as we know, but we have now inherited it. And that then brings us to the Phase 2 decree in this case. After we litigated all this matter for some period of time, the court entered the Phase 2 decree and selected the legal description. And the Phase 2 decree is tab B to Mr. Yolick's opening brief. And I really want to point out, make sure the court is aware that the legal description that was adopted by the court was prepared by a surveyor who was retained by Dr. Leninger, and then Mr. Yolick submitted that survey along with several others to the court for consideration as to what the location of the easement should be. So when you look at the Phase 2 decree, Exhibit B is in its entirety the submittal of the affidavit of the surveyor along with the resulting legal description. And the important thing to look at and realize is that this is the survey of the existing road out on the property. You drive out there today, go up, look at it. What is there on the ground now is what was surveyed by Dr. Leninger's surveyor and submitted under this survey.
The phase two meets and bounds equals the upper road.
Now, yes. However, there is certainly some confusion that starts to come in when you talk about the upper road and the lower road. Penny Compton's testimony was very clear that back in the 50s, when this switch occurred, they had the lower road and then they moved to the upper road. The lower road was essentially abandoned and was not used and is essentially virtually invisible today. Can hardly be discerned as to where it is. So you go out there today and there's no upper, there's no lower, there's an existing road. And that is the road that the trial court adopted as the legal description using one of the surveys that Dr. Leninger presented to it.
Survey, I'm curious about the timing of it. The court actually ordered the surveys done to determine the meets and bounds of the upper road, but that assumes that there's not this wide strip of land from the draw to the fence, right?
Yes, and to try to give a little bit of understanding as to this wide swath of land, the very last page of my brief is a map that looks like this. And this was a map that was prepared by the state's surveyor, Gary Hanna. Because what we were confronted with is it's the middle of four different surveys by Mr. Newby, who was Dr. Leninger's surveyor. And no maps that, you know, were attached to them. So it took some effort, and the state surveyor looked at it and proceeded to conclude what is the area that was being described. And when you look at this, the large gray area is what I believe Mr. Yolick is suggesting to the court should be the location of the easement. And as the state surveyor determined, it's approximately 28 acres. This is the area where the cattle would have wandered as they were being driven across the Thompson property to get to the Lemon property.
Is the area the cattle wandered circumscribed by natural or man-made features like a fence or an elevation above which they just wouldn't climb?
Well, the record does not contain an awful lot of evidence on that exact question. There are no cliffs on either side, and exactly where the cattle wandered is probably subject to debate. And we should say that the state certainly doesn't dispute the fact that cattle wander. Penny Compton, in her testimony, I think succinctly said it very clearly. You know, everybody knows that cattle don't stick to a road, is how she said it, without there being, of course, some fence or something else sticking to keep them to it, the cowboys or whatever.
What delineates the borders of the gray area on the fence? Is its feature is arbitrary?
Well, first of all, you do need to realize that it was Dr. Leninger's surveyor who did submit the legal description for the gray area. I think the attempt was to have on the east side of it the existing creek. On the right side is not entirely clear because there is certainly, for example, one area where the road is farther to the west than the gray areas. So it's not entirely clear to me exactly what the basis for the gray area was.
Is it your position that the road, the upper road, which is the easement that was ultimately, I think, decreed in the decree,
yes,
does that fall entirely within the boundaries of the originally recorded easement?
We are left, of course, wondering what was the, quote, original easement, you know, a strip of land between the fence and the draw.
We don't know. Okay.
The fence apparently was in existence and was quite close to the draw, but, you know, at this stage, we really don't know from the language.
The trial court found that most of the road lied outside the boundaries of the original recorded easement.
Yes. But I think Mr. Yolick's opening brief very much agrees with the state's position. What happened was the parties, after the 53 agreement was put in place, decided that, you know, the more logical place for that road was higher up. Penny Compton testified that there were some problems with the lower road and its drainage and so forth. And so with the consent of the Thompsons, the Lemons relocated. And there's numerous cases I cite in our brief, in addition to the Eisenberg, several cases that very much support the proposition that when the actual deed itself, the written document, is ambiguous as to the location, it's very appropriate for the trial court to look at the subsequent use of the parties as to how to determine where the easement is located. And that is indeed the existing road, or if you would call it the upper road. Where we really differ with Dr. Leninger is Dr. Leninger says, oh, but the cattle wandered off that road. They wandered across the area, and the easement should be set at that. That's how it should be decided. We've heard nothing, and there's no evidence in the record, and we've heard nothing in argument here as to why it is necessary to have a 28-acre easement, hundreds of feet wide at places, in order to transport cattle. Cattle certainly can be transported along a roadway, and indeed, were there to be fences constructed, presumably that would even facilitate the movement of the cattle. So what we are then, I think, left with is a very unreasonable easement that is being requested by Dr. Leninger that would impose a burden on the serving estate that is totally unnecessary and unneeded for one of the purposes, not all, because certainly the express language of the 1953 agreement contemplates not just cattle, but other access. And I think it should be clear here, the state has not had any dispute, nor there is an issue here regarding the use of this easement area. The only question is its location. They can, you know, drive up and down it as often they want for whatever use. It's merely the location of the easement that really has been in dispute.
It appears to me that the easement speed is different than described.
Well, again, we are left not really knowing, given the ambiguity in the 53 agreement, exactly where it's located. I mean, that's the confusion. Had the parties back in the 1950s surveyed in an easement and had a meets and bound description, a legal description that had clarified where it was, then certainly that would be a governing document that would tell everybody where it is. They didn't do that. We have this very vague and ambiguous language of, you know, between a fence and a draw, a strip of land, and we don't know where that is. What the trial court then looked at and considered was subsequent, you know, use by the parties. They moved the road apparently. The existing road then is what the court looked at and said, this is the location of the easement.
Trial court get from the point in 2007 of saying that the easement, most of the easement, the upper road, which he was considering to be the easement, was outside the boundaries of the original recorded easement, to later, and therefore was not an easement. I think he concluded that most of the upper road was merely prescriptive or permissive use. By the time he got to his final decree, he said the upper road is the easement. What findings did he make that justified that change? Do you know?
Well, the written findings from the court you have, we certainly briefed and argued over the form of the final decree.
We would have to look to the final decree for that.
The final decree, it was adopted by the court. The court proceeded to take one of the five surveys that Dr. Leninger presented and adopted that as the decreed location of the road, which is, again, the location of the existing road. Thank you.
May it please the court. The reason that the western edge is, as I described in response to the question that you raised during Appley's argument, is because Dr. Leninger at trial stipulated that what he needed in order to comply with county regulations and for safety reasons was that he needed a 3-foot edge to the current upper road in order to maintain it properly. And so that's why what we're requesting is the western edge is essentially based on that stipulation, with the eastern edge being what the express grant is. And so it certainly is possible that the actual western edge of the easement does in fact go farther west than 3 feet from the current road. I believe, Your Honors, that you have actually pinpointed the real problem in this case, and that is that there is no evidence before the trial court, nor was there, that the upper road was the easement. And in fact, there was quite a bit of evidence that even the party's subsequent use that was fairly recent, is as recent as the mid-90s or even late 90s, was that the easement was quite, that it did include the upper road, but that it was quite different from the upper road, and particularly on its eastern edge, that it went quite a bit farther. Now, with respect to this issue of ambiguity, and that's really the last thing that I want to address to the court, first of all, there was no pleading of ambiguity in the trial court. There was no finding of ambiguity by the trial court. I understand that the appellee's brief essentially asked this court to assume that there was a finding of ambiguity. I'm not sure that it's really that critical, because quite frankly, I'm not sure that there's a real dispute as to the facts or the evidence that was adduced in the trial court. Where I think that the dispute lies before the Court of Appeals is the interpretation of the express easement. And I believe that that certainly is a question that is under a de novo standard of review, because it is a question of law, a question of contract interpretation. There, for that reason, I believe, Your Honors, I think that it is appropriate to reverse and render. I think there certainly is sufficient evidence, and particularly, as Mr. Cameron stated, there actually are other, in the trial court record, there actually are other legal descriptions, including a legal description that includes the precise easement that we prayed for at the beginning of my opening argument before the Court of Appeals.
You asked for reversal or, in the alternative, remand for further findings. What specific findings do you think are necessary?
Actually, Your Honor, I don't believe any findings are necessary, but I could see that it might be possible for the Court of Appeals to determine that the trial court should make further findings as to the precise legal description of the 1953 easement. And that's where it would be appropriate, possibly, to remand the case to the trial for further findings.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused.